Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway once again, but it's an unusual opportunity this week because we have a special visitor here. First, of course, not to say that you're the unspecial visitor, Alan, but Dr. Alan Shartok is here.
We know all about you, Rex. We know
CEO
what you do. We know how you do it. Go ahead.
Northeast Public Radio. Thank you very much. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. And our third contestant here today is Stu Shinsky, editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal here in New York. Stu, your first time on the show.
I appreciate the visit, gentlemen. Thank you.
I love the name Stu Shinsky. It's alliterative.
It is.
You remember English class where they taught the guy taught to you about alliteration, The English teacher who always had Tums in his mouth, and the Tums fiddle was at either end of his mouth when he was talking about alliteration.
You should have been a writer, Alex.
Stu Shinsky. It doesn't say that six times. It's the perfect.
It sounds like a bad baseball player's name, which is exactly what it is, actually.
Were you?
I tried, but I was a bad baseball
player.
There
you go. So how did you end up? How do you happen to be the editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal? Where'd you come from?
I started at the Journal in 1989, and I've been with the Gannett Company for 23 years, and I've worked at four other locations at USA Today, Cherry Hill, New Jersey, Norwich, Connecticut, but the Hudson Valley is my home. I love the Poughkeepsie Journal. I love who I work with. I love the character and the tradition of the Mid-Hudson Valley, and I just really enjoy what I do every morning when I wake up.
Is the Gannett complex, is the Gannett group a special group compared to other newspapers?
Well, I think so, but I'm clearly biased. I think the company is innovative. I think the company has put a very strategic plan in place to transform during this economy. Our paper is quite successful. We are, of course, a changing model every day because of the industry evolution, but what we always come back to is what we need to do to serve our readers with strong content, strong advertising information. And what we have found is that if you do it right, and we think we do it right, people will respond.
And speaking of you were talking about the tradition of the Hudson Valley, the tradition of the Poughkeepsie Journal has been, and I'm not just saying this because you're here, I was saying it before you walked into the studio, has been one of excellence. As we speak, we are just a few hours after the annual awards banquet of the New York Newspaper Publishers Association, where the Poughkeepsie Journal won more awards than any other paper in the state. 10 awards in its circulation class for everything ranging from investigative reporting to editorial writing, design. And this is not unusual. The Journal has often been in this position, of course.
We are very, very proud of what we do. And the awards to us are nice, but honestly, it's not about the awards. It's about the quality of the work that we consider and others consider award worthy. So we don't look at one aspect of the operation and say, we got to do this. We try to really make sure that from basics to very special stuff that we're trying to do the very best we can every day.
Now, how do you deal with, we were talking about the changing realities of the digital era has forced upon all media. So how do you cope with the fact that in an era of reduced resources, we actually are asking our journalists to do a lot of different things?
Well, I used to identify myself as a journalist. Now I identify myself as a person who manages change.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, we still do a ton of journalism. It's what we do. But the way that we have found to go through this transformation is you have to decide what you want to be. You can't do everything that you did in 1991. It's impossible. with the staff that we have versus with the staff that we may have had back then. And we are a smaller staff, but we focused in. We have different skill sets. We have job positions that didn't exist a year ago.
Like what?
Interactive developer.
What's that?
It's a graphic artist online, frankly. Someone who can build multimedia projects, things where you click and something buzzes and flashes and stuff like that. It's a storytelling tool online to create an experience for a reader to look at something as interesting as the history of blizzards in the Hudson Valley.
You've had to fire people. How do you do that?
It's awful. We've had to eliminate positions, none in the last several years, frankly, in the newsroom. You explain the economy. And in my experience, it has never, ever been about the person or the person's skills.
Do they ever get mad at you?
I'm sorry?
Do they ever get mad at you when you're doing
yes.
it?
Yes.
Well, more often yes. you have to keep Kleenex on your desk.
Yes.
It's more of that than anger. One of the interesting things to your point.
Yeah, you've had to fire people too, haven't you, Richie?
Not most recently, but it's awful. To the point of Gannett actually doing some things that are innovative, sometimes this is done before it really pays off. Like that interactive developer is probably not something that you can say, here's the margin on right. that. But you're actually putting yourself in a position to be there when the audience gets to you.
Exactly right. You know, one of the things that we were, frankly, a little slow on was the development of apps, an iPhone app and a tablet app. And we roared back, and we've got them going, and they're going gangbusters. So, you know, we were late on that one. And the lesson there was, okay, where is the strategic plan? How do we refine this, and where do we go? And that's why we have some new job titles, new responsibilities. We've changed how we look at our marketing data greatly. I mean, I grew up putting commas and sentences and writing stories, and it was fun. And now I analyze marketing data.
Now, the only downside about having you here, Stu, is that you're another old white guy. Well, you're not as old as Alan is, of course, or even me.
No, I'm old. I'm 72 years old. But you're much more distinguished. You look distinguished. You're tall. You have gray hair. If you were trying to find a guy who should portray you in the movies, you would be you.
It would be me. Yeah. That's very kind. Very kind.
Yeah, I'm old, yes. Distinguished, I'll leave that to others to
But define. You're just a guy. And one of the topics we got to talk about here actually is a gender issue, and that has to do with this, that in media coverage of politics, when there are women candidates, there frequently tends to be a mention of what women look like, less so than men.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, didn't the president just get into trouble for that himself?
Yes, he did.
For referring to the Attorney General of California.
I thought it was ridiculous. I'll be honest with you. I'll get mail on it, but I don't care. You know, people dress for success. They dress to be attractive. Women dress to be, these guys there, or they're both looking down at their papers. Let everybody know that they don't want anything to do with what I'm saying. But I'm telling you right now that, you know, people don't put mini skirts on and look all frilly and the rest of it for no reason at all. They want to be attractive.
It's a celebrity-obsessed culture.
You're really playing right into our hand here, though, Alan, because the fact is a survey of 1,500 likely voters has found that news stories that mention a female candidate's appearance hurt her chances of getting votes against a male candidate.
So what do you mean by that? I don't get it.
That a woman is actually disadvantaged when people focus on her appearance, even if it's really good, even if she looks really
good.
Well,
I've always had a theory on this.
Yeah?
It's a theory that is unfortunate. I mean, I don't still want it to be this way. But that I think that people whose sexuality is not in your face have a better chance. Usually, often it's older women, the Prime Minister of England or Golda Meir or others have a better chance because they are seen not in that, you know, reproductive part of their lives. It's terrible. I want you to know that. But I do think it is something that I happen to have noticed.
You're speaking of women as opposed to men, though, because probably the sex appeal of a male candidate works to their advantage, doesn't it?
Aside from me saying that you are, you know, a handsome fellow, a distinguished fellow who wears, you know...
who is not running for office.
And Alan is correct.
Who wears $500 shirts. Nobody cares about men. You know, the best you can do as a man, and I try to do this, is your tie. But otherwise, you know, nobody cares about the way we look and dress.
And it's true with women, with crime stories. You know, when it's a pretty young lady who is a victim of a crime, the coverage just seems to be much more expansive than perhaps it would be if it was someone who might have been not tall, perhaps heavy set, and did not have attractive hair. And you see it elsewhere.
How come?
I think because people perhaps want to relate more to people who are more attractive. That, you know, the celebrity-obsessed culture, you know, People magazine being the number one magazine in the country.
I think it's the sexually-obsessed culture.
There is that, too.
And people consider it more of a tragedy if an attractive person is hurt.
Such a loss. Loss of potential. And other people have lost potential, too, who maybe aren't as pretty as others.
But I think Alan's deluding himself if he thinks
that... How dare you? I'll see you on the Weehawken plane.
If he thinks that the... I'll get the plane to Weehawken. If he thinks that voters pay no attention to male appearance and male sexuality candidacies. Yeah, exactly.
Bill Clinton.
Mitt Romney, wasn't part of his appeal the fact that he looks like a president?
I would point out to you, sir, with all of your belligerence, that he lost the election.
But Clinton won twice.
Right. He lost the election, but he won the nomination.
I think he lost not because of the clothes he wore, but because he was a phony and everybody knew it. There was nothing there.
I think he lost because of that little tape that came out, the comment about the 47 and...
I don't think so, but we could talk about this all day long.
We could.
Just my opinion.
We could. More important things to discuss here, including a...
There was the dog on top of the car.
Gail Collins is coming to the Capital Region soon to speak, by the way, who is known, of course, for including mention of the Romney dog, Seamus, in every column she wrote about him for the longest time. I think she actually made it all the way through the campaign that way. But she's known for much more than that. She's a very insightful columnist and journalist.
And you didn't say a word about the way she dresses either.
I didn't. I would not.
Certainly not.
Certainly I would not. A FoxNews.com reporter is facing jail for refusing to identify police sources. This is one of those things that you have to stay on top of. Whenever a reporter is facing prison, it has not really happened in this country since Judith Miller of the New York Times.
I beg your pardon. Do you ever remember Brenda Starr?
I do. She did go to jail sexually,
did.
Didn't she?
Yes.
A comic strip.
Right.
For those few who have forgotten her. I loved her.
And didn't she? That she's gone, right? Wasn't that?
Yeah,
strip
the strip
canceled?
Is no longer appearing.
Oh, that's
appearing.
Really
yes.
terrible.
Yes.
I can't. But she became
Star reporter.
Multimedia journalist, I think, shortly before her demise.
Yes.
Before she was laid off. So it's a sad thing. Anyway, a 32-year-old supposedly investigative reporter, FoxNews.com, named Jana Winter, had done a piece in July when she reported that the suspect in the Aurora, Colorado shootings kept a notebook filled with violent notes and drawings that he sent to his psychiatrist days before the shootings. Now, this story was picked up everywhere. It was repeated all over the place. And now a judge is in a pretrial phase. A judge in the case involving the shooter wants her to reveal where she got this information. And she's, of course, saying no. And he's threatening to hold her in contempt.
What do you think about that, Stu?
It's the age-old story. The names change and the cases do not. Judith Miller, this has happened so many other times. And it's going to come down to the resolve of the court, the resolve of the reporter, and the support, frankly, that the reporter gets from her employer. I mean, sometimes it's something as simple as the legal bills are mounting too much. We need to bring this to an end. But if there really is the conviction, if there really is the fortitude to stay with this and take it to its end, I mean, Judith Miller spent a good amount of time behind bars.
85 days.
That's
behind bars for refusing to reveal her source. Finally, she was released. But
she also revealed the source, didn't she? I think in the end, you know, the question became...
I think she went back to the source and got permission.
Well, that's the way they got out of it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But this is an extraordinary thing. Actually, George Freeman, the former New York Times lawyer who actually represented Judith Miller, makes the point that courts, that really in only the very most of extraordinary circumstances should the confidentiality ever be breached. And in what circumstance could this be viewed as being extraordinary? The question being that whether this could taint the jury pool. Well, if you've ever covered a trial and listened to the voir dire when the lawyers question the potential jurors, you recognize, pardon me, but how stupid jurors are and how little information.
Oh, God, his name is R. Smith at TimesUnion.com.
I mean,
for all of you who ever sat on a jury, you stupid people.
Just so few jurors really pay attention to the news. And the notion that this one little minor story could taint a jury pool so that Mr. Holmes could not get a fair trial, as opposed to all the other evidence that has been presented in the media that could affect a jury
pool. This is true arrogance on your part, as usual, Rex. You think that citizen responsibility for testimony, honest testimony, should go to everybody except the people in the press. You're wrong, sir.
Well, I'm not saying that we don't have a responsibility to be good citizens, but I also think that there's a responsibility to protect the First Amendment that is something important for all citizens to pay attention to.
Yeah, well, you know, there's always those questions. As the Nazis marched down the street in Skokie, there were people who said that the issue is, you know, the First Amendment. You're saying the same thing here. And you're right. Reporters have to be protected. But, you know, if a guy's on trial for his life, he's entitled to the same recourse that everybody else has, I think.
Well, I just hope in this case that the reporter maybe tried other ways to get this information. And it was maybe in the end gotten from this one source. But a resourceful reporter says, okay, if you gave it to me, can I corroborate this? Can I get this independently? Is there a document that I could obtain that says this information? And in essence, less the reliance on one single source if the information is so critical.
But Stuchinsky, when that reporter, Brenda Starr, whatever her name is, comes to you and lays this on your desk, what are you going to do? I mean, what's the first thing that comes through your mind?
First thing I do is I say, well, how do we corroborate it? I did this yesterday in my newsroom. How do we corroborate it? Can we believe what this person is telling us? Because we're putting our neck out there. And sometimes you have to do that, but are we doing it for the right reason? If we're not going to reveal this source, it's our name, it's our reputation, it's our credibility. So we need to be rock solid that this source knows what he or she is talking about. And B, we need to try, if we can, to corroborate it somewhere else.
This taxes me to the hilt, and I'll tell you why, because it's a Murdoch operation. And I am the Fox people, of course. And when you said before, hopefully they have enough money to continue. I'm sure, you know, that they have that. But it does tax me because, you know, I think she's got a very good point, as Rex points out, even though I take the other side from time to time. And it's very hard for me to do anything like that for anyone.
Oh, yes. A shrinking violet that you are. Yeah, if you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, political scientist and CEO of Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Stuchinsky, the editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal. And we're about to talk about how journalists get paid, and not quantitatively, because we all know it's too little. But the question actually is what basis, and there is an increasing reliance as we move into the digital age of performance-based pay. That is, Gawker, for example, has a big board that keeps track of page views for each writer. People get paid based on that. Forbes has a monthly incentive program for staffers on a range of metrics that includes how many new followers a reporter gets on Twitter that month. The difficulty is, of course, when you look at these metrics, my goodness, if you're going on page views, we all know how to get more page views,
right? This is so troubling.
Yeah.
This is so troubling. I mean, it becomes a popularity contest. I mean, there's a lot of news that just is not sexy. It's just obligatory good journalism. If you were to look at
the Board of Education did this yesterday.
Exactly. I mean, and on Twitter, I mean, I can, you know, send out blind emails and get 200,000 people to follow me. But, you know, it's not about that. It's really about the interaction. In theory, I think if you're doing this right, it's not the number of people who are following you, but it's how you're sharing, it's how you're engaging, it's how you're building that online conversation with them.
That may be the difference between the Poughkeepsie Journal, the Times Union, and Gawker. In other words, what's the mission of the, I mean, today's New York Post and Daily News, I mean, they have a big contest of who can have the prettier woman on the front page of the paper with the shortest skirt. Mm-hmm. So we know who and what they are, and we respect, you know, your abilities, Stu, but you have two different products.
It's two different missions. We're a community-based news organization. They're New York City tabloids. That works for them. What we do, we think, works for us.
All that said, of course, you can't put out a boring newspaper, so there is a certain level at which you need to be judged based upon whether you're creating a product that is desirable by the consumers, right?
Well, depending what the mission is. And also, right. I would point out, this is the whole new look. Professors are getting paid with merit increases based on what they do. And teachers, there's a whole move to do it with teachers. And so is this not so surprising.
And what do you tell a young journalist who may not have the experience or the reach or frankly, the marketing savvy? Well, you wrote that story, but only 300 people clicked on it, so here's $10. What do you tell that guy?
Yeah, exactly. It's really troubling, especially because now in the digital age, we have all kinds of metrics you can use. If you purely look at page views, then, of course, you're going to look at things like the Miss America swimsuit competition, which, by the way, does get very good numbers. And, in fact, if you put up photo galleries, which we do a lot of, you can get huge page view numbers. But there are other ways you can measure engagement. You can measure time on site.
And how do you do that again?
There's analytics.
Mm-hmm. Digitally, yeah. You can...
Well, explain it to stupid old me.
Well, how much time does somebody spend? Do they click through to things in a story? You can get these digital assessments of...
Yeah, we look at unique visitors per day, per month, per year.
Yeah, we
Are we
too.
Growing the number of unique visitors who come to our website? And coupling that with the frequency, how often do they come back to the site? Once a day, twice a day, three times a day, whatever it is. Sure. And you add all of that, and you can extrapolate just how involved and engaged your readers are.
Well, no, that's very interesting. But can we talk about politicians who punish radio stations for saying bad things about them and
sure.
not showing up? I mean,
has that ever happened here? You have some people
No. We know that Andrew Cuomo does not come here. I have to think it's one of the stupidest things ever. I mean, it's on him to tell you the truth. I said to one of his assistants one day, well, you know, if he doesn't do that, you know, then it's just not smart of him because our listenership is his potential, you know, 400,000 people every month is discreet, as you say, is what is important. But okay, they do that. But I know that, for example, the tabloid, what's the right thing to say about him? I never like to say his name here, but the tabloid sort of guy runs around. And in the beginning, he and Murdoch and his friends all made peace with Cuomo, and now they don't like what Cuomo's doing. They're attacking him. The guy attacks him in the thing. Now he has a little radio show that very few people relatively listen to, and he's angry that he's being punished by the same governor that used to reward him for kissing his posterior.
Well, the governor went on that show a lot.
Yeah.
He did.
It was his main way of going.
And now you're saying he's not now?
No, he's saying it. The tabloid, what do you call those guys? Rats.
Oh, that's the technical term.
Today's vocabulary lesson.
Explain that more clearly to someone.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I love it when you do that. Stu, you've never heard this
before. When Rex clears his throat.
That means we're in trouble.
I think that's a transition about to come.
That's right. No, but is this not in the, shouldn't this be considered a politician's self-interest to say, you know what, if somebody is not going to be nice to me, I'm not going to go on their show or talk to their newspaper or TV station?
Well, it depends on the level of insult. In other words, if a guy is standing there like this fellow for the Murdoch organization, you know, yelling and screaming about how the taxpayer has been betrayed and calling him all kinds of names, sure, shouldn't go on. But if it's about, you know, punishing somebody for something that somebody once said to his father, you know, and it's all of these years later, and then you can't talk to 400,000 people that are, you know, that's just stupid.
But now here's an example. CBS News, for example, called out the 14 Republican senators who have said they're going to block a vote on any gun control legislation. All 14 of them said they just didn't have time to go in the air to talk to CBS News about it. CBS was trying to get a balanced story, you know, to try to get both sides of the debate. And when these guys refused to go on, CBS named them and said, who's not going to talk to us?
Good for CBS.
That very common journalism technique. We asked so-and-so, they declined to comment.
In fact, at the end of virtually every story, when somebody doesn't come back, we always say, and you always say, exactly what you just said.
Right.
We contacted them, but at the time of this radio show, they weren't available.
So we're by press time, and that's just letting the reader or viewer or listener know that we did make the attempt. This is not to be perceived as a one-sided story or something with an agenda or a bias. We tried to reach out. They declined to participate.
Well said, but I also think there's another interpretation possible, which is that these dirty rats are avoiding us.
Certainly possible, yes, because they wanted to reach out, and if they were able to, they probably would have.
And don't forget, we the taxpayers are paying a lot of money for their teams of flacks to handle all of these questions.
And that's exactly right. And I think there is an obligation on the part of public officials to involve themselves with the media because we are, in effect, asking questions on behalf of the voters, and they're avoiding
us. At the very least, issue a statement. If you don't want to do the exposure of an interview or the interaction, or maybe you're not ready for questions, issue some sort of comment that could be used.
And the next time you come on, Stu, we're going to explain the rules about having your cell phone off so that when you hear ding, what that's all about. It's all too late now, Stu.
You
don't
too
even
can be
about
a part of this conversation. Write us at media@wamc.org. It was probably Alan's, and he's blaming you for it. media@wamc.org. Alan Shartok, Stu Shinsky, Rex Smith, thanks for joining us this week on The Media Project.
But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policies...